Hey, did you hear that you can't call functions in Python anymore? That's right, they're all deaf.
Hey, howdy, howdy, ho, it's Daniel Markman here. Nerd Roundup, it's another week, it's another Nerd Roundup.
And if you've never been to a Nerd Roundup before, you haven't missed a damn thing in your life. But you're here now, so stop by and have some fun. Nerd Roundup, every week we look at technical articles, we get together and just shoot shit and have some fun. The serious purpose of all this is not to sell books or promote ourselves. The serious purpose here is to show you that you can disagree and you can have a wide variety of worldviews and experiences and still have fun. In fact, teams that relax and have fun do better than teams that don't. And it's an important lesson, and the only way I know to show how to do this is to do it myself in front of you. So I'm no charge for me doing it myself in front of you, as opposed to the people who joined me last night. Today we have a Scott Hamler and a John Kern. Guys, good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you.
Remember the money-back guarantee on the jokes. Scott, this is your first time on Nerd Roundup. What have you been up to the last week or two?
Last week or two, just been working way too hard. And luckily, I was up at my cottage over the weekend, so that was a very good thing. But was able to spend some time there. But other than that, not much other than working ridiculously long hours, unfortunately.
For those who do not know you, could you like tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm currently working at the Project Management Institute, PMI. I'm one of the co-creators of the Discipline Agile Toolkit, and along with Mark Lines. And we've been helping people understand and hopefully get better at this Agile and Lean stuff and help them learn how to continuously improve.
Now, you have sort of a trifecta. You've got you have a bit of a technical background. You also have a process background in the PMI stuff as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I'm a recovering process nerd, but I'm also I've got a tech background. Still play around. I'm actually horsing around just a little bit right now with 6502 machine language because there's something wrong with me. And so it's process stuff, business stuff, and techie stuff.
I got fond memories of 6502. That was the processor you could understand everything that was happening.
Yeah, it's a simpler platform, that's for sure.
Somebody asked online, what was it like in the early days to go to BBS's? And what I remember about the early days was there was just always this spirit of adventure because you really didn't know what was going to happen. It was always something new, and it was like a continuous game of Zork where you're interacting with the machine and something is interacting again. And it wasn't that sort of thing where it is now where you're never bored. It was more like you had to go explore it.
Yeah.
John, what have you been up to the past week or so?
Oh, just some more helping teams. Did a couple episodes this week with behavior-driven development and just also trying to fight the good fight and help folks basically learn how to more joyously deliver value to their clients. Not always easy, but... yeah, and I was just going to say with Scott, it's been a while. Scott and I can easily get in trouble together. But if you notice cottage, pretty sure that means like he's from Canada.
I didn't want to get right into the pejoratives right away. But yeah, with Scott, and, we all speak Canadian here, so you're good. You're at home. We're friends here.
Or cabin, if you know.
And I was a little concerned, with your starting joke, like, oh no, you might get Scott started on dad jokes.
Well, he does this on dad jokes. He should be doing that. He should be in charge of the dad jokes, I think.
No. that can't possibly go well. Just trust me on that.
Scott, I always like interacting with you online because I always picture this really smart kind of snarky person.
Snarky is right.
The word snarky.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, Scott tells you jokes that they're funny, but then you realize, okay, he's also sort of poking at you while he tells you the joke, which makes it even more entertaining, in my opinion.
Yeah, I do my best. Yeah, but snarky is a good description. Just leave it at that. Yeah.
I've been working with the task library in the new .NET system. I'm kind of having fun with that. They're continuing to try to wrap their threading async stuff into more and more complex abstractions and tasks. It's like the latest iteration of that. Okay, so first article we have here is these parents built a school app in a city called the COPS. So Stockholm, Sweden, built an app for the schools. They had 500,000 people who were stakeholders. They spent $100 and some million. It was a piece of crap. So the parents actually got involved and started writing an API on top of their API. And then Stockholm threatened to send them all to, tried to send them all to jail because how dare you write a system that people like. It has a happy ending. They finally came around and said, okay, wow, maybe you parents are really involved and care about the system. We shouldn't be such assholes. But for a while, they really had the police show up at the place and they reported to the data privacy person.
I was expecting to see something like with the word syndrome in it.
Was this a public API or did they break some security protocols here? Like what happened?
Well, it was yes, no. And the way this worked out was like, I don't know, 12 or 15 different systems made by 5 different vendors. But the vendors put all the data behind a public API that then they had their crappy interface to call to. And so they were actually exposing data, in some cases data they shouldn't. But the parents just hooked up to the stuff that was already there and made their own layer on top of things. And they apologized. Once everybody realized that they were exposing data they shouldn't, everybody backed it back out. There wasn't any sort of an intent to do anything wrong.
Yeah. So it seems the vendors might have wanted to put some a little bit of security in place there. But was this a legal issue where the court struggled to understand basic technology issues to begin with? Like, was there this unfortunate education process of explaining what computers are and APIs are and stuff like that?
Reading between the lines, it looks like this was sort of an education process for the folks who were contracting out the IT work. And so once they found out that the parents were developing their own thing that they liked better, they thought, well, hey, we've got a vendor relationship with all these other guys, maybe that's bad for them. They have IP issues here. Maybe they have the GDPR in Europe for privacy.
Oh, for sure, which is harsh, rightly so.
But they got quite afraid, and they got feared. And because they were feared, they did everything they could to cover their ass. And then finally realized, as long as it's public information, we should encourage parents to get involved. So it looked to me like they shut it down before it got to court, instead kind of realized the error. It's a happy ending. Realized the error of their ways.
Yeah. Yeah. So did they ever explain what the where they got confused on the term public API, or?
Yeah, I don't think they realized that the vendor had built it the way they did, and they sort of got a whole lesson on IP law, APIs. Like, it was a learning experience for the school board.
Fair enough. Yeah, I've seen teams that were the business folks. Got surprised about the realities of IT would be the polite way of saying that. So, but yeah, fair enough. Well, hey, it worked out fine. Yes. Good.
It could have went south. I think the FBI had a case management system in 2000. They spent close to $1 billion. IRS had a $4 billion restructure. There have been projects that have been total crash and burns, and this was not one of them. So that's a good story.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I did my first book, I did some research on IT projects that were disasters. Oh, wow. That made me sad.
Yeah, they are. I remember early on in my sort of as I was still having a real, a job and doing freelancing on the side, some guy that I was working with was talking about a massive project that was going down in some big New York City firm, and they canceled it at $20 million. And I remember saying to him, "So what were they saying at $19 million? Just curious."
They were saying we're 80% done.
Right? Yeah.
Which is the exact same spot they were at $10 million. Years ago I ran a survey on this very issue. Along the lines, I asked a series of questions along the lines of, have you been on a failed IT project? And 100%. But then I started asking some really reasonably harsh questions along the lines of when did you know things were crapping out? And one of the questions was, and then did you do anything about it? So, and then, yes, we knew something was going wrong, was some ridiculously high number, yes, we did something about it with some ridiculously low number. And one of the questions I asked was, have you ever been on a project where on day one, you knew it was going to crash and burn? And it was the majority of people said, yeah, I've been on at least one. And then did you do anything about it? And the answer, and then once again, ridiculously low number of no, you know, so we knew it was going to die and no, we didn't do anything about it. Just went along.
Yeah, it takes a certain kind of fortitude to work with folks who are in projects that are like that and you're trying to help them out. And you know that it's a bad spot. They know it's a bad spot, but somehow they're unable to make a difference. And even as an external change agent, sometimes you can't make a difference for them. It's not fun.
Yeah. Well, there's just so many issues, right? Like, and so many things that are reasonably out of your control. And so many decision makers that don't really understand what they're looking for and they're hoping for the best. And what I find really offensive is when they've failed over and over and over and over and over and over and over again for basically the same reasons. And they're not learning, they can't observe. And then they get really upset when you point out, you've failed like this 17 times previously. Hey, it's gonna go this time. Oh, it's gonna work this time. Yeah. It's like, I bet not. But gotta get on that treadmill, right? Literally.
When we come into work with people, a lot of times they'll do this thing where they go, hey, we're all for change, but this one thing we really don't want to change. And you're like, okay, well, maybe we can work around this by doing other things. The problem is, in a large organization, there are 12 different people sprinkled throughout the org. They all have that one thing. They're all different one things. And you put it together, you get a dysfunctional system, and then you ask why, and you get, it's him, her. You don't get it. They're unable to determine why. They can tell you it's broken, but everyone will give you a different answer why it's broken.
Yeah. Or it's broken, and some of the people are involved, nobody wants to have a harder conversation with. And it's like, sometimes you just have to have, it's not pleasant, but we have to have some conversations that you just would prefer not to have. And, but until we get it over with, we're never going to get past this. And, but it's hard. I'm not saying it's just certainly not easy. But.
Yeah. I often don't know how to deal with things at that level. For example, an organization wants help with trying to do better at kind of maybe what I'm loosely would call product ownership, product management, whatever the term is that's up front, upstream of, and we build the stuff. And so a lot of it in my mind, predicates a little bit on how to, how do they organize, how do they think about it. So started asking questions about that. Lo and behold, they had a recent reorg. And so now, because they were complaining about how long it took to get something blessed to go through the pipeline, because you had, three VPs, for lack of a better word, having to do something. So how do they organize? They gave each of the three VPs their own silo. And the silos, unfortunately, like one of them is off. Like, uh-oh, so wait, yeah, organized on like functional, like layer, not like, right? I mean, it's the exact opposite of you want to deliver a thin slice. Well, no, we've actually organized around the back end person, the authentication person, and this person. I'm like, oh no. So, but, and that's off the table to have conversations about because it was just recent, right? They weren't doing well, however else they were organized. So now they're reorganized like this. And it's like, I feel a little bit queasy stepping into the arena with that.
Yeah, you'll ask them, yes, I'm actually in charge of things that start with the letter R. And you're going to say, okay, that seems like a pretty good way of doing things, guys.
Yeah, I see how that's working for you.
For now, everything we're doing is going to start with R. We just have to figure out really rough.
Well, yeah. But the worst problem is the guy that got stuck with everything that started with the letter T.
Oh, and, wow, yes.
Dumping grounds, right? Oh, it's a T. Sucker.
The login.
The login, the system, the customer.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a tough spot to be in. I think that John and I have talked about this before. One of the things that happens when you code a system at the bottom level is that you learn about the problem as you're coding the system. So you're probably wrong in a lot of ways that you don't realize until you start interacting with the math and logic underneath. And so as a good programmer, you should come in expecting to learn something about the system from the code you're writing that you then have a conversation. That disappears completely by the time you get past the project level. It's just past the project level, somehow they feel like they can determine what these silos are going to be and that they're going to work that way. And I don't think they know better. So I mean, it's not that they do their own purpose, but it's a naive way of doing things.
I don't think they know better at all. Because you know, I used to do a lot of project recovery stuff and still do sometimes. And things go poorly. And the people involved are doing the best they can. They really almost always are, right? They really are good, decent people working together, trying to do what they can do. But they fundamentally don't understand some basic issues. You know, it's like the school board. They're doing the best they could. But they just didn't have a clue. And they learned the hard way. And a while back, about a year ago now, I was doing this review of a project that hadn't gone very well. And most of the people involved, it was their first IT project. And they were making decisions. Yeah, so you know. Right away, you're doomed. And they were. So, but their instincts were all wrong. And, you know, if it had been if they were building a bridge or something, their instincts were mostly right. But given that they were building an IT thing, their instincts were almost all wrong, and their instincts for how to recover, even to understand what the problem was, just wasn't there. And then once we sort of pointed out what was going wrong, then their instincts for how to recover were just dead wrong. Like I just burst out laughing at one suggestion the project's late, we should throw more people at it. And I said, okay, that's it. Let me explain something called Brooks's Law to you. And it was news. It was news to them, right? They go, are you sure that's the way it works? And yes.
Since about 1970, we're pretty sure.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's about, I'm pretty sure I'm right. And I'm basing what you're telling me, I'm pretty sure if I was to remove several people from this team, I could probably speed them up really quickly. Because you know, there was a few problem children.
But I think the key point is that your intuition fails you, and I think it fails you even if you're a really good technical person who gets promoted to project manager, for instance. It's the reverse holds true. Your skills you learn as programming doesn't apply to people's skills. There's just sort of different universes almost.
Yeah, that's a good point.
We're totally different. Yeah.
So this next one's opening this article voids warranty, and this is just yet another in sort of the essays about right to repair and why don't we own the things that we think we own. And this guy, I think, did a pretty good job at hitting it from a new angle. A lot of good stuff in here. We got a little bit of socialism about three quarters of the way down, but he didn't stay too far in it, so it was a good read.
The one thing that struck me, and maybe because I think it's true, is like the signs in that parking garage that say not responsible for articles left. No, that's just somebody trying to deflect you from not pursuing any kind of legal thing. It actually is, I think that's his point too. None of those stickers mean anything. Most of them are completely illegal.
It would never hold up in court.
Right.
Yeah. I think the top comment on Hacker News was, so this guy throws a brick through your window, and on the brick there's a note, you know, by acceptance of this brick, you now agree to the repair of your window by my company. Thanks.
Well, yeah. Fair enough. But yeah, John's absolutely right. These agreements are total nonsense or mostly nonsense, but nobody's ever going to, you know, so many people will get deflected by that. Right. It's worth the while. You might as well try.
Yeah.
It's, I don't know, a couple hundred bucks to put up those signs in a parking lot, right?
Right.
You might as well try, because if you can avoid even one court case, those signs more than paid for themselves.
One of the deeper points he made that I found kind of interesting was, you know, what we're doing actually by prohibiting people from repairing stuff is we're prohibiting sort of innovation, prohibiting people learning about stuff who don't have money. We're actually sort of bifurcating society into, really poor people who have to buy things with no warranties on it and work on their own, and really rich people just throw stuff away after a year or two and never worry about repairing. And I thought that was a good take on the fact that this is an anti-progress type thing we're doing.
Yeah.
We span right in the middle. So I'll take out a couple of just recently. We use a term here out in the country called free cycle. So it's called stick it out by the, you know, we don't have a curb. There's no curb. You know, we don't have like things called sidewalks. But nonetheless, a couple of dehumidifiers that were not getting very effective, you know, and I just replaced them, right? I limped them along. I said, screw it, they're not working. This was after the recent like Hurricane Ida came through. I was like, okay, these are not doing the last bit of cleanup. So put them out by the curb. Somebody else comes, you know, asks about them, and then they can repair them. Cool. You know, I have like an old pool pump. It needs a new bearing. I looked up, you can replace bearings.
Yes.
And yeah, some people will do that and others will.
And like that person learns about repairing the humidifiers while he's doing that, right? The world may get a new way of doing humidifiers we didn't know before. There's a benefit to society to have people tinkering around with stuff.
Yeah.
And we do that sort of thing too in Toronto, but I think to be fair, if you're trying to fight a hurricane with a humidifier.
Oh no, I also have some pumps.
Work, man.
Yeah.
It's not work. You know, get three or four humidifiers maybe.
Right. So what's humorous, there's round two of that, we haven't done it yet, is I have three dead sump pumps in the also in the basement during the same hurricane. So, because I burn them out. So I usually have spare. So I had to buy two new ones. But I'm going to take those three dead sump pumps and do the same thing. Put them out because someone can probably get them to limp along and probably get them fixed. And if not, people will take the copper out. People will recycle it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Better than in the junkyard.
You don't want to roll the dice on a mediocre sump pump though.
No, these are supposed to be pretty good. These the ones
until they weren't.
Yeah. I mean, they do decent duty, and then, yeah. You know, we live in an old 1700s house. I'm not saying like it's the basement of a modern.
It must right? have been some kind of hurricane, John. I mean, you lost three sump pumps, two dehumidifiers. I mean, wow.
Well, the other sump pumps were we only lost one. The other two were from prior death. You know, death. They're just sitting in the same. I'm just now that there's three of them, I'm like, all right, time to go. Free cycle.
I'm noticing a pattern though. Have you ever thought of like moving to somewhere where you don't get hit by hurricanes?
Well, Pennsylvania, it's not horribly known for that, but they do come up.
This happened in Pennsylvania? What was that hurricane?
Yeah.
Ida. It's amazing what comes up here.
Yeah.
Tons of, you know, just more than we've ever had in the basement. It was pouring out of the walls. Again, there's old stone walls. I've never gone down, I filmed it. I've never gone down and heard running water and saw like a little stream coming out of the wall, pissing into the 3 inches.
Generally a bad thing in your house.
It's a bad thing. Yeah. To hear running water and like little and trickling water. That's not supposed to happen.
Indoor pool is fun, but not when you don't have a plan ahead of time.
Yeah. So I have to bug out in a couple of minutes. I just want to share a story. So we got hit by an ice storm in Toronto. Yeah. So Toronto gets hit by ice storms here so often. Only in the winter, though. And we got hit by one summer.
That's 11 months of winter.
We have a couple weeks of summer, right? So a few years ago, we got hit by a really bad storm in the summer, and one of my neighbor's houses flooded. The basement, like the basement flooded. Bad news. So they had to, bring the contractors in, replace the entire basement, just burn through cash, and they literally got it finished 1 week before an ice storm where the power went out. They foolishly went on vacation with the power still out. When they came back, the power was out for over a week. It was so bad. And when they came back, the pipes had burst in the basement. The basement had completely flooded, and there was a brand new basement. They now had like an ice flow coming out of their front door.
Oh, wow.
So bad. So, you know, they also lost the main floor. And basically they just called the contractor up and said, hey, it's us. Do you want to come and do the exact same thing again? So, yeah, bad news. But Wow, that's there good. Might be something on, you know, with this global weather change stuff, but
it's the woolly caterpillars. Where I live, every year before winter comes, you'll be in a store and somebody will say, "Hey, I wonder what the winter's going to be like." And they'll go, "You know, woolly caterpillars are looking pretty fat this year, and the acorns are not as big. Therefore," and they'll say, "the winter's going to be bad or good or whatever." And
right.
All I know is you bring up acorns and woolly caterpillars and explain, just say whatever.
Yeah, the woolly, yeah, definitely. I think it's the size of the black band on the woolly bear. I forget though.
Yeah. Yeah. But the interesting thing is the small acorns are a leading indicator of a lack of squirrels in the spring.
That is true. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. And if fat squirrels in the fall are an indicator of a lot of new squirrels. That's
babies.
In the spring.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much.
I got
to bug out. I will do my best to make it again in the future.
Awesome.
Great conversation. So there appeared to be homework to be done here, but yeah.
Homework?
Anyway,
there's no homework. No
reading of the articles. But anyway,
you must be new. There's no reading the articles. Right?
Oh, okay. I didn't know, man. It's my first. You know, I'm a virgin.
You have to buy lunch for everybody. Yes, you.
Oh, okay. Something like that. Yeah, I got it. New guy buys all the beer or something.
Oh, yeah.
Something
like that. That too, yes.
That'll work.
Good seeing you, Scott.
Free beer.
We're easy.
Yeah. Okay. Anyways.
Good seeing you
guys. We'll definitely be back.
Yeah.
We'll all right. Cool. Later. Ooh. Bye.
Yeah, it was good having Scott come by. Very cool.
Yeah.
Scott, I've known Scott for, we've talked about this, probably 10 years or so online. I don't think I've ever had a conversation with him until today.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I think we probably go back, man, almost 20 years maybe. It's been long. And certainly when we could look up when model-driven architecture was a thing.
Oh, yes. That's right. He's a big NDA guy.
Well, we would be on various panels talking about that, and we were always the sort of the snarky pair. Anyway, yeah, we got in trouble here and there, so to speak, just by being snarky about it. It's pretty fun, though.
So one of the things, Scott, as you probably heard, Scott's a climate change kind of guy. I don't know what the climate is because I'm the Great Pumpkin, but he likes to tell jokes to sort of poke at people who don't believe, as he does, about climate change. And that's fine, but it always challenges me to come up with a reply. This time I use the woolly caterpillars and the acorns. A reply that sort of deflects him off of where he's going. Because he can get uncomfortable times. Scott's a great guy, but that's why I enjoy talking to him so much. You have to kind of stay on your toes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this next article is Explaining Machine Learning Models, a Non-Technical Guide to Interpreting SHAP Analysis. And I really wanted to read this, so I finally did. Basically, the long term of this is a bunch of different graphs you can use to have artificial intelligence programs explain to you why they made the decisions they did. It really sort of gets you started on that. And with way too much, this could be like 4 hours of stuff, but notice that there's something called a beehive diagram. That is a beehive diagram. Did not know that. There are no bees, but that's what they call.
Yeah, I've never heard of that.
And they also have a waterfall somewhere down here. Yeah, here's a waterfall, and here you have different factors, either positive or negative, depending which way the bar goes. So it sort of takes the top dozen things it uses to decide and gives you sort of a histogram of how much each thing sort of weighs against the other things.
Yeah, those sorts of things are kind of fascinating how they work and how you can tweak things, much like climate models, I might say.
Yeah,
and I learned about this in aerospace, right? The big challenge about, quote unquote, you know, modeling the flow around an object like an aircraft is you often have to correlate it to something real, and how many data points can you take to correlate your model to make it more accurate. And now our modeling has probably come a long way, but I remember that early on back when I was in school, they talked about, and that's why it's challenging to model the atmosphere, because the number of quote data points we have to try to empirically balance our our models is woefully inadequate.
Yeah, my issue with climate change isn't whether we know or, I mean, it's the fact that there are like a dozen different things all wrapped into one, like, title called climate change, and we're supposed to argue, like, yes or no. And it's like, no, this is like a dozen different things, and I'm not, and if you don't have the patience to go to these dozen different things, we're not going to get anywhere at all, really.
Yeah, I would agree.
But yeah, the modeling, I would love to see the new flight simulator Microsoft. I'd love to have a tour of that code. I bet you that's pretty cool.
The real early one would be really simple, but the current one, the models that we use for the F-14, big chunk of it is also the flight control systems modeling how all that works.
And, you know, as you know that C++, you can kind of pop out to drop a similar code right in your code. And I wonder, I've read several articles about like when you really want to optimize to use a similar in your code. Then I've also read that lately the compilers are so good that you don't really gain a lot by going that far.
Probably not. Yeah, there. Matter of fact, I reversed some 60-bit bit twiddling because it was so damn hard to figure out what the hell it was doing that I questioned the performance gain by doing it wasn't worth the lack of any normal human being able to understand what the hell the code was doing. Right? It was jumping into way too low of level code.
I think that the skills, you know, just sort of flailing around, I think the skills you probably use to optimize at the assembly level, you could optimize using those same skills at level two up and, you know, like it down in the weeds if you don't have to.
Yeah.
Science Publisher retracts 44 papers for being utter nonsense. And these are papers, one second. Simulation of sea surface temperature based on non-sampling error and psychological intervention of music education. These are the titles. The stability of rainfall conditions based on sensor networks and the effect of psychological intervention for patients with urban anxiety disorder. It's just like a string of stuff just kind of strung together. And these people accepted and published them.
They could have even been, quote, peer-reviewed. Because it doesn't mean what people think it means. People who throw that in there, not only just say, hey, I read this paper and it was, well, was it peer-reviewed? Or I read this paper and it was peer-reviewed. Still doesn't make it gospel, right? That, at most, is the start. Okay, cool. At least somebody else thinks it was a reasonable experiment or hypothesis. Now go out and replicate it. Try to do it. Or poke holes in it. So peer review doesn't mean, because you can get a bunch of friends and get your stuff peer reviewed.
Oh, yeah. And I think
y'all think the same way. It doesn't mean anything.
Seems to be the theme so far has been, you know, complex systems that we just sort of trust at some level that we really don't understand what's going on. Like the school board didn't know how the APIs worked. This guy, they were just publishing stuff because it was peer reviewed. Systems happen to be very complex and you can't sort of gloss over that all the time. Sometimes, yes, but not all the time.
True.
Escaping Cosmology's Failing Paradigm. This is a super cool, kind of nerdy article about cosmology for people who are not scientists or math whizzes. And to make a long story short, his point is that we're finding stuff we don't understand, like dark matter, dark energy. And instead of trying to take existing models and keep sort of tweaking little variables, maybe we should just take the whole damn thing apart and try to put together a new model. Great, great argument. Points out some stuff I didn't know. For instance, we can only measure with reasonable accuracy about 5% of the universe, how far away it is. Using indirect methods, we get up to about 20%. And then the other 80%, we're just sort of relying on the things that we use. It's like a circular argument. We assume these things are true. Because these things are true, we find this evidence to prove that this thing is true. And so they're stuck in a paradigm.
Sure, and that's the way things have always been. Like, including, do we orbit the sun or vice versa? Yeah.
Well, right? So, well, yeah, the guy who's in charge of things starting the letter R. You know, something goes wrong. He says, well, hey, this obviously did not start with the letter R, so I'm not responsible. We define things in ways that then sort of gets us off the hook later on to actually have to do any kind of work.
Yeah, it's hard to be able to stand back and try to have a wider perspective sometimes.
You know, I think the best example I saw of standing back was the guys who did the LIGO, the Gravitational Observatory. They actually created a tiger team. They did like a red-blue team where one team was trying to screw up the other team. And so the system's built assuming that bad data is coming in and it has to sort it all out.
That's interesting, yeah.
Very cool. Next article is what I learned from losing $200 million. This guy's a physicist who went to Wall Street, did a lot of derivatives trading. What he learned was Wall Street ain't physics. There's a lot of stuff you don't know about investing, and he had to sort of get a humility kind of lesson, and sometimes you just got to guess. It's probably tough for him. This is a Wall Street Journal article, which I had a Dickens of a time actually seeing because of the paywall. Nuclear power is the best economic solution by far. This is like news from 1970.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, I was listening to the Reason Roundtable this morning. It's a libertarian magazine. They talk about both sides of the aisle. And one of the things they brought up was, we do a really, really sucky job of looking in the past and determining what we did wrong.
Yeah, I've been saying this for a long time, and all the folks in the Navy and nuclear-powered ships have been proving for decades that it's safe. And I often wonder what would it be like if you had carrier-sized power plants sprinkled around.
I think the folks in the Air Force are wonderful folks. They're smart. They do a good job. However, the Navy should have been put in charge of space exploration, because space exploration is like being on a submarine. It's going to be relied on nuclear power. There's just so many parallels in submarine and naval stuff that the Air Force should have never gotten it. It's not their job.
And Star Trek, right? It's a USS. I submit that Star Trek was more lineage as the Navy.
Yeah, I think that the Air Force got in because stuff, like the reasoning being stuff in sky, Air Force, and that's tenuous.
Yeah. Air Force gets to land on giant runways. You know, like everything the Navy does is hard.
Air Force has some soup. Like the B-52 is a super cool machine. The SR-71, they have some really, really cool stuff. But they're really not in the business of going away far places in a self-contained system and doing important things. They're just more like they sit back at the base, they send bombing missions out for people. It's not the same thing at all.
Right.
Yeah, your plane crashes, the people back at the base, they're still fine. But if your submarine crashes, you're all gone.
Yeah.
This next article is from Sam Altman. Sam Altman is a Y Combinator guy. I think he took over after Paul Graham left. He's reinvesting in Helion, $375 million. Helion is doing fusion. He's saying they're going to have working fusion by 2024, and they're looking to try to get 1 cent per kilowatt hour. It's amazing.
Is this over in Germany?
No. Now, this is one of the U.S. startups. The story here is that the Europeans they're still spending billions of dollars on this huge tomahawk or whatever, that they're making progress slowly. Meanwhile, there's about four or five companies in the U.S. that are fraction of that budget are actually making as much progress as they are.
Were you trying to say the word, are we called tokamak?
Tokamak, that's it. Not the tomahawk, the tokamak.
Yeah, I remember. In the cruise missile engine program, this one series of studies we did had to do with inlet distortion. So how well does the engine handle? You know, it's nice when everything's smooth flow coming in through the inlet, everything's nice and you know, head on. But what is it like, you know, maybe because the inlet is sort of popped up above the fuselage or below the fuselage, or you had angles, different angles of attack. So you get distorted airflow. Now how does the engine respond? Because essentially you're getting different loads as the blades pass through it, right? So So we used a 50,000 hertz data acquisition system, which meant we could put an array of probes to measure the pressure differentials across the face of the inlet and kind of then measure things in the engine. And you could have one channel sampling at 50,000 hertz or 50 channels at 1,000 hertz, that kind of thing. So we thought, and this was pretty advanced for the day and for our normal data acquisition rates. It was really cool because we got some really good graph and data out of it. Then we went to Princeton to the Tokamak. And they were, this big machine, one of those circular things, right? You're walking around and you see gazillions of wires coming out of it. And they were describing their data acquisition to us because we were kind of interested in that. And it's ridiculous. And even back then, right, the amount, because things happen in such a blip that they just have to have this insane amount of data acquisition. So it's kind of like the blip happens and then just a torrent of data comes streaming into the system and then they analyze it. Yeah, so that was my brush with the tokamak.
If I understand the tokamak problems correctly, they're trying to compress and heat a ball of plasma to be like...
I think so. It was this big toroidal looking magnetic thing that generated all kinds of, when they fired it, you only got that for a very, not a very sustained amount of time.
And the sun, of course, is a huge gravitational body that has equal pressure. By the time fusion is happening, there's millions and millions of tons of sun above that fusion. It's pressing in equally, and it's pretty difficult to sort of recreate that in the laboratory.
Right.
The plasma keeps like poking out in different ways than they're not expecting it.
Right, you need just a bunch of lasers to focus in that little tiny spot.
We're trying to, I think, program or sort of engineer a 360-degree spherical containment cell to such a degree that it's never, ever been done before. Now, the people in the States are doing this, they've got some kind of self-reinforcing system. It's a spiral, sort of spiral magnetic system where the system itself enforces its own stability as opposed to us trying to turn the knobs and stuff on the outside to get the plasma working. And that's why they're moving along a lot faster. That's what I read. But yeah, Sam Altman's a big benefit in this, a big big guy who loves this. He says he's dropping his own money in it. Good deal.
It's the dream. Always has been.
Bob was making a point it a few months back. I'm like, Bob, no, this thing's turning a corner, man, my friend. In 5-10 years, we're going to be seeing fusion reactors, no doubt. Not a doubt in my mind.
Nature is, still far ahead of us and keeps teaching us, and we can't match it.
Yeah, I hope that we don't get some sort of China syndrome with fusion reactors where we get all scared.
That's what we do in the United States, while other countries like France went whole hog on nuclear, or Brazil went whole hog on sugar beets or something like that.
Yeah, I can think about half a dozen issues in my lifetime where we got scared about something, made the wrong choice, and then just stuck with the wrong choice. Added an item.
Yeah. Hopefully that's not COVID.
I'm thinking of COVID, war on drugs, the nuclear safety issue. There's just a big list of stuff where we just decided, boom, this is the safest thing to do, and then we were immune to ever looking back and revising stuff.
Yeah. That's bad. That's not healthy.
No.
And that's not how we teach. That's not how we coach. That's not how we run teams. Yeah. That's a death knell.
Somebody asked me how the United States got so overbearing. And I think the answer is that each generation felt like it was doing something so unique that it sort of looked for ways to bend the rules to make the system work. And you just do that 12 or 15 times and you've got a system where all the rules are kind of broken.
It's an interesting thought.
Every generation, starting with Jefferson. I mean, what was it? Adams had the Sedition Act. Well, you can't say anything bad against the president. What the hell? Jefferson got into office. And then Jefferson decided to buy Louisiana, which he had no power to do whatsoever. So everybody just kind of hacked. We made this wonderful system, and we spent 230 years trying to hack it.
Because we're humans and not angels.
Yes. This next one, speaking of hacking systems, this is yet another I want to build a web server in one line of code thing. And I just, I admire this guy. I feel sorry for the guy. It's just, I had a lot of feelings reading this thing. His desire was, I just want to write this one line of code. You're like, app, get, blah, blah, blah. Hello, world. And then the comments on Hacker News, as you know, we're a very tender short, we programmers. We said, you know, dude, you're like the 5,000th person to ever do this.
Welcome to Rails.
Yeah, Rails. Everybody does hello. I just want it to be very simple. And then they write 40,000 lines of code, so it'll be very simple.
Yeah, MDA was a model-driven architecture. Similar to Rails and being able to generate stuff and use the metadata, right? Use your models, have some sort of a template approach to, you know, like what he's got in here for, the route, the query, all that kind of common boilerplate stuff that, again, you know, for me, it's music to my ears because I'm always about build a consistent. If there's five domain concepts that need to show themselves in the UI and persist, don't do five different ways of, you know, model view controller. Don't do five different persistence libraries, you know, unless for some reason you really need to. But in general, right, consistency is a weapon. So I get it, right? I get Rails, I get MDA. MDA, at least when we try to build it in a tool course, we tried to make it adaptable so that you could go in and tinker, because that's part of the deal is, you know, it's never sufficient or rarely sufficient to just leave it at the one line magic gizmo. Yeah, you can get a bunch of boilerplate book and stuff working, but it's usually not sufficient for true requirements. So make it so that you can bend it, but
it
never took off.
NDA really taught me what my job was. This is kind of a weird thing to say. I mean, I think being a programmer is a great thing. It's a lot of detail. There's TDD. There's a bunch of languages and tech. But at the end of the day, your job is to sort of manage complexity that you're bringing from the tech world to the user. And MDA is all about sort of doing that.
Right. It resonated with me just because manually, for years, that's how I tried to develop applications with teams is that level of consistency. The domain model rules all, basically. You know, the rest is how you persist it or how you show it.
You
know,
that can change.
Yeah. But the business, the business was the main driver. So, and making all the boilerplate stuff be as simple as possible, so I don't have to spend money on it, is music to my ears, because that's not providing value to end users. That's a necessary evil. So, what can I do to make that? Minimize that and maximize being able to show cool, powerful features that the users really want.
And that really, I think that's where we are with this example thing he wrote, is that a lot of people are trying to simplify the hello world path of doing web programming, and they all have different ideas of how it can be one line or two lines. But really, it's that day-to-day process of continuing to have a simple word like everybody kind of falls apart. MDA was good because you could continue to organize your stuff as you were talking to the business user in terms you both understood, such that, you know, it was a conversation that went ongoing for maybe a year or two. A lot of these libraries, you can do something kind of happy path for a day or a week or so, but then you're down in the weeds and you're not talking to the business guy at all.
Right. They get disconnected and, To me, software development isn't as hard as people make it out. It's just all the misconceptions and all the people that are kind of in the way.
I agree, and I think that my point I made a few weeks back, we don't know how to manage software projects, because this NDA discussion, this simplicity discussion, is the pivot point between the coders and the business, and that's the kind of conversation you're supposed to be managing if you want to be a whatever manager-type person, not features, Gantt charts and all that bullshit, because that'll happen magically. It's all really good if you do your job right. But it's not, you can't beat somebody at tennis by watching the scoreboard. You have to beat somebody at tennis by actually playing tennis pretty good.
Yeah, or reading about it.
Or reading about it, yeah. Or going to conferences. So this next one, this is Ford came out with a new concept truck in the last week or so called the Ford F-100 Illuminator. And this is an old 1978 Ford pickup. You can see it right here. Except for it has no engine. They rebuilt the body. It's got an electric engine inside. They got two electric engines inside it.
I gotta think there's a lot of people that would buy this just because some of those cool old, you know, whether they're old Ford pickups or Chevy pickups, you know, when you see them, I remember there was this restaurant we went to in Guatemala out in the country, like a Swiss Rincon, some crazy Swiss person. So it's just funny, like, whoa, look at this. It's like we're in the Alps. Huh. And there's like kick-ass, like, I forget if it was a Ford or a Chevy pickup about this era that's mint condition, and it's, yeah, I don't know, for me it's like, it's a cool, that's cool. Yeah, I mean, I like making noise and, you know, lots of horsepower, but you can't beat the acceleration of electric.
So you look inside, it's got like a glass cockpit in there. It is a sweet looking ride, dude. And what they're showing off here is something I didn't know they were doing as well. This is the E-Crate. And the E-Crate idea is, hey, we're just going to sell you drop-in electric engines that will replace your current gasoline engine.
Ooh, that's a fascinating concept.
And so the bugs aren't worked out. Right now you have to source your intermediate tools to do the adapters and all that stuff. But the goal here is to retrofit or provide a path for retrofitting everything.
That's a really fascinating idea. I do like that they preserved the glove compartment.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever put a set of gloves in a glove compartment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tire pressure, the little warranty things.
Yep. Right now in my new used car, I have a GoPro in the glove compartment.
Cool.
Just in the off chance of recording fast acceleration with somebody in the passenger seat who's not expecting it.
Yeah, you got a pocket rocket. You got a fast car, right?
I do. Except it's a big luxury car, yeah. Yeah, it's funny.
I've thought about getting a motorcycle many, many times. I think it would be a hoot, but just kind of, I don't know, a lot of danger there.
There is. They're fast as hell.
Yeah, but they're fun. This next article is why testicles have taste buds, because we have to know. I just saw this, I'm like, what the hell? And it's a true thing. It turns out that taste buds are found all over your body. We don't know why. And they don't report back to the taste center of the brain, so they're not doing what other taste buds do, but they're doing something important. And we're still trying to figure out what it is, and that kind of made it a neat hacker story.
So, since you brought it up, there we were in just a few weeks ago, a couple weeks ago in Morocco, in the, you know, in the markets where regular people are shopping, and they got the big slab of meat hanging, a big hunk of beef with, I didn't inspect to see if there were any taste buds on this thing. But the guy pointed out the reason that's left on there is to prove this is meat from a male. And that's the last thing that gets cut off of it. And then they sell that, but they leave that on till the very end while they, you know, cut pieces. You know, it was a big hunk, right? It's like a half a cow hanging there, basically.
What if cannibals did as well?
So it's interesting that it was important to know it was a male, you know, steer, basically. Or bull, I guess. Yeah,
those are the hunks of meat are called primals, I think. And that's it's a big piece of muscle and or muscles that they sell that then be processed later on. So this ends by saying that even though there have been plenty of people on TikTok trying to use their testicles to taste things, it actually doesn't work that way. They brought a doctor in to explain it all, and it's an extremely fascinating side story. I didn't know where that story was going. You know, we were in Morocco last week, and I was like, oh, I don't want to know where this is going. Man sampling coffee with it. So finally, the story that you sent is it's the joy of collecting stamps from countries that don't really exist. And this is pretty interesting. I like this.
Yeah, and the reason it's come up is sadly, nobody in the U.S. collects stamps like I did as a kid.
Oh, wow.
You know, or coins, for that matter. I mean, sure, if you spend $200 or $300 on an investment grade stamp, I guess maybe you could, you know, use it as expanding your portfolio. But my my wife has been trying to sell my collection in different bits and pieces and first day covers and, you know, all kinds of really cool things that I got a lot of pleasure out from, you know, from being a kid all the way through. I'm gonna guess maybe late 20s or something like that. I probably kept buying. Now, luckily, she puts postage stamps, you know, a lot of mint sheets, even if they're 8 cents, you know, on like a box to mail it. So the post office enjoys. But there were some funny stamps from places I never heard. Yeah, and like NIEH, and like just, I remember as a kid, Bhutan, and at least that's a kingdom near Nepal. You know, but, and I remember a lot of African countries, really pretty stamps. So it turned out the United States mostly, you know, started the philatelic kickoff maybe in the 30s or something like that. And then they started producing stamps for collecting. So that's why most of them, anything like post 1930 is pretty worthless because there's gazillions of them. And, but anyway, yeah, this was a hoot.
There's the province of Bumbunga.
Yeah, and there's another one that's even funnier. The tutu is hilarious. The read where it's from. A floating house.
The floating house is somewhere in Seattle.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
And these guys, this Molossia.
Yeah,
they don't just stamps to celebrate their war of independence. They've got like right. A guy with a gun shooting.
Yeah, yeah, just that. You know, I just thought. This was like a last ditch Google of, you know, are these things worth anything to anybody in any country? And this pops up. That's hilarious.
Yeah, Heliotown, another place at Santa Fe and San Jose, two cities in the United States are the official homes of the country of Heliotown. this is hilarious. In 1949, this guy, James Magnan, claimed all of outer space. For his own country. And he started issuing stamps. You have outer space mail. It's the nation of celestial space.
Yeah, I just thought it was a hoot.
Yeah.
It's clever.
Very clever. And the thing is, they're saying that a lot of these micronations, by issuing some sort of stamps, they want to sort of gain legitimacy because they have stamps.
Right.
That's wild.
Tonga.
I know somebody who lived at Sealand for a while. That was kind of wild. That's the little place this country they made on the oral platform for a while. The guy that did the network stuff out there.
That's funny.
Okie dokie, let me do the end of show thing. Hang on a sec. You have lost and wasted yet another hour of your time. We're happy to have you. It's Nerd Roundup.